He meant after Clarissa died.
I've been saving my money mostly, but I'm not sure I can afford a gunship,
Bobby said, keeping her tone light, trying to make a joke of it. We'll finance it. Split the joint account 6 ways, then set up a payment plan for the rest. Based on our past income, it should be an easy nut to cover. You pay any new crew out of your end. The Rossi's your ship.
Why me? Why not Alex?
Because there isn't anyone on this ship I'd rather take orders from. And I'm the world's worst person at taking orders. You'll make a fantastic captain. And you'll protect the reputation of this ship. It's weird, but that's something I find myself caring about. Bobby swallowed something that had become stuck in her throat, and she straightened up her back. It was all she could do not to stand up at attention. Military tradition died hard, and a captain handing over command of their vessel bordered on sacred trust.
I would, you know, she said. I'd see us become a cloud of gas before I'd violate the honor and good name of this ship.
I know. So, is that a yes?
I do wonder, Bobby said.
Holden nodded and drank his coffee, waiting for her to finish.
I wonder what the universe looks like without James Holden trying to ride to the rescue.
I imagine everyone will find things running a lot more smoothly, Holden said with a grin.
I wonder, Bobby repeated.
Chapter 8. Sing.
Sing was dreaming of wandering, lost in the halls of a vast spaceship, when the comm on his desk buzzed him awake.
Yes,
he croaked, even before he'd opened his eyes. There was nothing wrong with his taking a nap in his quarters. He wasn't shirking any of his duties. And the shakedown of his ship, the gathering storm, had meant working for 16 and sometimes 18 hours a day for weeks now. He couldn't continue as an effective leader and officer if he didn't take every opportunity to grab a little shut-eye. And yet, something inside him didn't want his crew to know, as if having the same biological requirements as other humans was admitting weakness.
Sir, we are nearing rendezvous with the Heart of the Tempest, came the reply. Lieutenant Trina Pilau, his navigation officer.
You asked me to...
Yes, yes, quite right. I'm on my way,
Santiago said as he rolled out of his couch and waved on the lights. His quarters were also his office, and the red folder containing his orders from the Admiralty was still sitting on his desk. He'd been reviewing them for the 50th time or so when he'd fallen asleep. Leaving them out was a breach of operational security, and one he'd have reprimanded a junior officer for. As he returned them to his safe, he told the ship to make a note of the lapse in his private log. At least, it would be part of the permanent record. And his superiors could decide later if it required further inquiry. He hoped they wouldn't. He took a moment to wash his face in his private lavatory. The cold, biting water was one of the perks of his station. He put on a fresh uniform. A captain set the standard for his officers. Appearing on duty, clean and pressed, was the minimum level of professionalism he expected from them, and so he was responsible for it in himself. When he was presentable, he opened the door that separated his private space from the bridge of the ship.
"Captain on the bridge," the chief of the watch snapped.
The officers who were not actively manning stations stood and saluted. Even the consoles, polished to a spotless shine, seemed to radiate respect. If not for him as a man, then at least for his authority. The blue of the wall matched the flag, and the sigil of his command, 3 interlocking triangles, had been built into the surface. It made him feel a deep, almost atavistic pride seeing it. His ship, his command, his duty.
"Is Colonel Tanaka here?"
Singh asked.
"The Colonel is in her briefing room with her senior officers, sir."
A twitch of annoyance troubled him, as much with himself as with his chief of security. He'd meant to have a quiet conversation with her before meeting with Admiral Trejo. He'd heard unofficially that Tanaka and Trejo had known each other before, and he'd intended to get her assessment of the man. But it was too late for that now.
"The con is yours," said Davenport, his executive officer.
"I have the con,"
Captain Singh said and sat in his chair.
"The Tempest has cut thrust and is awaiting our arrival," his flight control officer said, pulling up the range map on the main screen. "At current deceleration, we'll make final docking approach in 23 minutes.
"Understood," Singh replied.
"Com, please send Admiral Trejo my compliments and request permission to dock with Heart of the Tempest."
"Aye, sir."
"I'd love to get a good look at her," said Davenport.
"All right, let's take a peek,"
Singh agreed with a nod. The truth was, he was just as curious. Of course, they'd all been briefed on the configuration of the Magnetar-class battlecruisers, of which Tempest was the first. The old Proteus class had been retired, and this new generation was only now being deployed. He'd seen dozens of concept sketches and photographs of the ships under construction, heard rumors of the new technologies that they would support. This would be his first chance to see one of Laconia's most powerful battleships flying free in her element.
"Sensors, let's take a close-up look, shall we?"
"Aye, sir,"
said the officer at sensor control, and the main screen shifted from the docking map to a telescopic view of the approaching ship. Someone let out a quiet gasp. Even Davenport, an officer with nearly a decade in the fleet, took an unconscious half-step back.
"Good God, she's a big one," he said.
The Heart of the Tempest was one of only three Magnetar-class ships to come out of Laconia's orbital construction platform. The Eye of the Typhoon was assigned to the home fleet and the protection of Laconia itself. The Voice of the Whirlwind was still being grown between the spars and limbs of the alien orbital arrays, and while the fleet now consisted of over 100 ships, the Magnetars were the largest and most powerful by far. The Gathering Storm, his own ship, was one of the Pulsar-class fast destroyers, and he was fairly certain the Tempest could fit a dozen of them inside her hull. The Pulsar-class destroyers were tall and sleek in design. To Singh's eye, they were almost reminiscent of old Earth naval ships. But the Heart of the Tempest was massive and squat, shaped like a long vertebra from some long-dead giant the size of a planet. It was as pale as bone, too, even where the curves fell into shadow. Like all ships built by Laconia's orbiting construction platforms, it had the sense of something not quite human. The sensor arrays and point defense cannons and rail guns and missile tubes were all there, but hidden under a self-healing plate system that made the surface of the ship seem more like skin than not. Grown, but not biological. There was something fractal about its geometry, like crystals showing the constraints of the molecular architecture in the unfolding of shapes at higher levels. Singh wasn't an expert in the protomolecule or the technologies that it spawned, but there was something eerie in the idea that they'd built things partly designed by a species that had been gone for millennia. Collaboration with the dead left questions that could never be answered. Why did the construction array make the choices it made? Why place the drive here instead of there? Why make the internal system symmetric and the exterior of the ship slightly off? Was it a more efficient design, more aesthetically pleasing to its long-vanished masters? He had no way of being certain, and probably never would.
"Tempest acknowledges," the comm officer said.
"Remote piloting for dock now," his helm added.
And the main screen shifted from telescopic shots of the battleship to a wireframe course ending at the Tempest. Very well, Singh said with a smile. The Admiralty had entrusted him with one of Laconia's state-of-the-art ships, and they'd filled it with serious and focused officers and crew. As a first command, he couldn't have asked for better. That he and his ship were the tip of the Imperial spear was just icing on the cake.
Admiral Trejo sends his compliments, the calm officer said. He asks that you join him for dinner in his private mess.
Singh turned to his XO. Stay on the storm and keep the crew alert. We have no idea what reception we're getting on the other side of the gate and may need to deploy at a moment's notice.
Aye, Captain.
Rig for docking. I'll be in the bow crew airlock. Mr. Davenport, you have the con.
The Tempest's operations officer, Admiral Trejo's third in command, was waiting for him on the other side of the airlock. Technically, they were the same naval rank, but as a ship's captain, tradition dictated that Singh be treated as the superior officer. She saluted and granted him permission to board. The Admiral would have greeted you personally, she said as she led him out of the airlock and they floated down the short corridor to a lift. The walls in the Tempest looked like sheets of frosted glass and glowed with a gentle blue light, very different from the bulkheads of the gathering storm. But this close to the gate, it doesn't like to leave the bridge.
Fisher, right? I think you were a year behind me at the academy.
I was, she replied with a nod. Engineering track. Everyone said logistics was the faster path to command, but I just love working with exotic tech.
She stopped and tapped on the wall panel to call a lift. While they waited, the bulkheads began to pulse from blue to yellow.
Grab a handhold, Fisher said, pointing to one close by. Drive is about to come online.
A moment later, they both drifted to the deck, and Singh felt his weight grow until it was about half a G.
Not in a hurry, Singh said, and the elevator made a gentle beep, and the doors opened.
The Admiral's a cautious man.
Speaks well of him, he said as they began to rise.
Admiral Trejo was a short, stocky man with bright green eyes and thinning black hair. He came from the Mariner Valley region of Mars, but the traces of his accent were almost imperceptible. He was also the most decorated officer in Laconia's military, with a career that stretched back to pirate hunting for the Martian Navy even before the gates opened. They studied his tactics in the academy, and Singh thought the term military genius was justifiably applied to his career. He'd expected the private mess of an admiral and fleet commander to be larger, more luxurious than the one he claimed on the gathering storm. It turned out to be a table that pulled down from one bulkhead in Admiral Trejo's slightly larger office-slash-living quarters. The aesthetics were different, only because the ship itself was.
Sonny, Trejo said, waiting to return his salute and then grabbing his hand and shaking it vigorously. Finally all the pieces are in place. It's an exciting time. Would you like to sit, or do you want the tour?
Admiral, Singh replied, if there's a tour to be had, I'd be honored to see a little more of the ship.
She's a sight, isn't she? Call me Anton, please. No need for formality in private. We'll be working very closely together in the coming months. I want you to feel like you have complete freedom to speak your mind. An officer who won't share his opinion and insight is of no use to me.
It was an echo of the High Council allowing him to use his military title, the permission of a little familiarity in private to build a sense of approachability and rapport. Now that he'd seen it twice, he understood it would be expected of him as well.
Thank you, sir. Anton, I appreciate that. Come on along, then. It's too large to take in all at once, but we can hit the highlights.
Admiral Trejo led the way down a short corridor to a lift that stood wider than the one on the gathering storm, with rounder edges that left Singh thinking of the mouth of some deep-sea fish.
I've been refamiliarizing myself with your career to date. I'm afraid that, like most of the officers trained after the transition to Laconia, I have very little in the way of operational experience. The Admiral waved this away. The lift door opened, and they stepped in. The anti-spalling padding on the walls was gently scalloped, like the presentment of scales. Top of your class in logistics. That's exactly what this posting will need. Me, I'm an old combat commander. Spreadsheets give me hives. The lift descended with a hushing sound, like a million tiny bearings spinning at once, or the hiss of a sunbird. The small hairs on the back of Sing's neck rose a little. There was something uncanny about the Tempest, like he'd entered into a vast animal and was waiting to see its teeth. "Yes, sir," he said. "My orders were quite specific on..." The Admiral waved him off again. "Forget your orders for a moment. Plenty of time to get to that later. For now, I want to get to know you a little better. You have a family?" Another point. Duarte had touched on his home life as well. Another piece of the secret teachings of Laconian command. He'd read that a command structure took its tone from those at the top. He'd never seen it so clearly in practice before. He wondered whether he'd been meant to. If this was a conscious lesson passed from Duarte to Trejo to him. He had the sense that it was. "Yes, sir, my spouse is a nanotech scientist with a lab in Laconia City. She specializes in genetics. We have one child, Elsa." "Elsa? Unusual name. Very pretty." "My grandmother's. Natalia, my spouse, insisted." The lift stopped. The doors opened on a wide and flowing deck. There were no stairs, but a gentle undulation in the deck raised some workstations above others. It seemed almost random, until he saw the captain's station that could command direct line of sight to all the flight deck crew at once. The design was elegant and utterly unfamiliar at the same time. The XO caught sight of them and stood at attention, surrendering command, but Trejo waved him back. The Admiral was present, but not to take command. "Connection to the past is important," Trejo said as they walked across the gently sloping deck. "Continuity. We honor those who came before and hope that those we bring into the world do the same for us." "Yes, sir." "Anton, please." "Anton," Sing agreed, but knew calling the Admiral by his first name would never feel natural or correct. "We almost never call her Elsa." "So what, if not Elsa?" the Admiral asked. "Monster. We call her Monster." The Admiral chuckled. "Named for another grandparent?" "No," Sing said, then stopped. He worried that he might be oversharing, but the Admiral was staring at him, waiting for the rest of the answer. "We were not really ready when Nat got pregnant. She was just finishing her postdoc, and I was doing 2- and 3-month patrol tours as the XO and the Clio." "No one is ever ready," the Admiral said. "But you don't know that until after it's happened." "Yes. So when Elsa was born, I'd just rotated back to an administrative position, and Nat had moved to a more permanent research job, and we were both learning the ropes while a very insistent 1-month-old made her demands." Trejo led the way down a curving ramp at the side of the room. Hatches irised open as they approached them and closed again once they'd passed. The light came from thumb-sized recesses in the wall, perfectly regular in their spacing, but rounded and soft. Organic life, subjected to military engineering. "So," Sing continued as they walked, "we were exhausted. And one morning, at about 3, when Elsa started crying, Nat rolled over to me and said, 'That monster is going to kill me,' and that was it. She was Monster from then on."
"But you say it with a smile now, yes?"
"Yes," Sing agreed, thinking of his daughter's face. "Yes, we do. And that's why I'm here. Why you're here, hmm? You don't seem like the type of man who'd choose to go without his family. It will hurt to leave them behind for this deployment. It will be months at least before they can join me on Medina Station. Possibly years. But if I can give my daughter the version of humanity that the High Council has planned, it will all be worth it. A galactic society of peace and prosperity and cooperation is the best legacy I can imagine for her. A true believer, the Admiral said. And Singh felt a flush of shame that perhaps he appeared naive to the man. But when Trejo continued, there was nothing mocking in his tone. This will only work because of the true believers. Yes, sir, he said. And then, Anton. The Admiral led the way into a broad corridor, larger than anything he'd ever seen designed in a ship. The Tempest didn't have the closeness of other ships, the design constrained by the need to cut back every kilogram, to waste no space at all. It was a ship that claimed power by the shape of its walls. Singh felt a little awe at it, as he supposed he was meant to. Two midshipmen sat at a table, laughing and flirting until they saw Trejo. The old man scowled, and the pair saluted and scurried off to their duties. Singh realized that no one had spoken to them in the time since they'd left the Admiral's cabin. The tour might seem casual, but it was intended to be private as well. In the same tone of voice one might use to ask what the time was, the Admiral said, "Explain to me the tactical and logistical problems with controlling Medina." Singh stood a little straighter. Comfortable discussions of family were over. Now it was time to work. He pushed his sleeve back a bit to pull the monitor off his wrist and flattened it onto the abandoned table. He pulled up the briefing. He'd been preparing it for weeks, and the sudden, irrational fear that he'd overlooked something obvious, something that would show the Admiral that he wasn't a serious person after all, still lurked in him. It was an old, familiar kind of fear, and he knew how to push it aside. A wire-frame rendering of Medina floated in the air above the surface. "Medina Station," Singh said. "Assuming our intelligence is correct, it houses the hundreds of members of the Planetary Coalition and their personal staffs, including security. Add in the permanent staff and crew of the station, as well as trade union members passing through, and you get a conservative estimate of between 3,000 and 5,000 people on the station at all times. I would guess the number is actually double that." "Assuming our intelligence is correct." "Passive monitoring, even over the course of years, will always have a greater opportunity for error than active examination. And the surface interference of the gates adds an additional level of error," Singh said. The Admiral grunted and waved him to continue. He spun the rendering of the station, and hard points on the surface became highlighted in red. "The station itself is equipped with some defenses. A PDC network that provides missile defense brackets the station, and one torpedo launcher remains intact and usable from its behemoth days. 8 rails, automated reloading system, we estimate a total capacity of 40 missiles. "Nuclear?" the Admiral asked. "Almost certainly not. The lack of maneuvering capability and the confined nature of the ring hub makes high-yield weapons dangerous to the station itself." Singh adjusted the image and focused in on the hub station. A perfect sphere several kilometers across that sat at the center of the gate network. The purest and most active alien artifact in all the worlds they knew of. Dotted on the surface of the sphere were 6 massive railgun turrets. "The station's primary defense is an aging railgun network, first installed by Marco Inaros's people and disabled during the final conflict with his faction.
These guns are placed so that at least 3 guns and as many as 5 can fire at any of the rings. They're our design from back when we were still supplying the Free Navy with weapons. Older, out of date now, but capable of sustained fire at 30 rounds per minute. Assuming, of course, that they haven't made modifications to them. The rail guns. In the ancient days back on Earth, they'd have cannons that could fire down into the harbors when enemy ships appeared. The defense of the sea from the land. We got rid of the land and the sea, but the logic of it stays the same. The more things change, eh? Yes, sir. What do you think of them? Trejo asked. The design is elegant. Placing the defense battery on the alien station is brilliant, Singh said. He felt anxiety growing in his throat. Was this the answer Trejo was looking for? Any place else, and the railguns would have to compensate with thrusters. The station doesn't move. Or maybe it moves and drags its entire local context with it. Either way, it avoids having to worry about Newton's third law. And as long as it has ammunition, it can hold off attacks from any of the rings, or even several at once. Honestly, I'm going to be sorry to see it go. Trejo sighed. Rebuilding them won't be quick, that's true. But we have to look at the long term. Even if a replacement battery takes months to install and test, it will last centuries. I wish we could take control of them ourselves. But that's the Tempest's first target, while you disable the station's defenses. Then board and secure the station, the Admiral said. Yes, sir. Logistically, once the station's defenses are secured and the railgun network is taken offline, the Gathering Storms Marines, which we've designated Task Force Rhino, can take operational control of the station within minutes. When we control their comm array and access to the hub space, we effectively control all communications and trade for the 1300 worlds. You'll have operational control of the landing and securing of Medina Station. Is the task force prepared? Yes, Admiral. They've been drilling for this assignment for months, and my security chief is Colonel Tanaka. She is well respected. Tanaka's good. And good personnel are critical, Trejo said. What obstacles do you anticipate? The ship traffic coming into and out from the hub space is unpredictable. It's very likely that there will be one or more additional ships with some defensive capability beyond the use of drive plumes as weapons. How many and what their armaments are can't be stated with certainty until we pass through the gate. Also, Medina Station has been in operation for decades, and with a mission significantly different from her original design. The information we have about the initial configuration will be badly out of date. When we take control, there is the possibility of some local resistance, though that should be minimal. After that, it's a question of co-opting and improving the existing infrastructure and coordinating the supply chains between the newer planets and the better established ones, Sol system included. And then you fly a desk for a while, the Admiral said. I'd have to think that's the toughest part of your assignment, getting 1300 squabbling children to cooperate. High Consul Duarte wrote the book on governmental trade control theories back when he was with the Martian Navy. It's still the book we study at the Academy. I'm prepared to enforce the new orders absolutely to the letter. I'm sure you are. Duarte has an eye for talent, and he selected you personally, the Admiral said, then pointed at the briefing diagrams floating in the air between them. And you certainly seem to have done your homework. Yes, sir, Singh said, then cleared his throat. If I may speak freely, sir. I think I already made my feelings clear on that. Yes, sir, Singh said, but the anxiety still tugged at him. I'm absolutely certain of this portion of our plan. My worry is the Sol system. Intelligence says that the Earth-Mars coalition has been steadily refitting and rebuilding their fleet, and that it is at least at the pre-war levels of preparedness. When external resistance to our plan comes, it will come from them. And while we have newer ships, they have the benefit of an officer corps that fought in two serious wars in the last few decades. They will have vastly more battlefield experience to draw on. The Admiral paused, considering him. The bright green eyes seemed to dig under his skin. Singh couldn't tell if the man was pleased or disappointed. When he smiled, it seemed genuine.
Experience and home territory are real advantages for them, you're right. But I think you shouldn't worry about it overmuch, the Admiral said. The Tempest was built for one purpose, and one purpose only. To render every other power in the known galaxy irrelevant.
Chapter 9. Bobby. They sat in the galley, the same way they always did. Amos and Clarissa beside each other. Alex at the end of a table across from her. Holden a little apart, and Naomi closer to him than to the others. Bobby felt the anxiety humming in her throat and legs, like she was about to get in a fight. Worse, because there was a moment of calm that came with violence, and there wasn't going to be one of those here. The dinner had been, mushroom noodles and black sauce. But everyone had stopped eating when Holden cleared his throat and said he had an announcement. When he'd broken the news, he'd seemed rueful more than anything else, and he covered it up by talking about numbers and business, going over their last few years and the projections for the next few. His decision to step down, and Naomi's too. His nomination of Bobby to take his place, and all his arguments for it. The others listened in silence while he turned to the details of the sale. The noodles had all gone cold and sticky in their bowls. Naomi and I are cashing out a quarter of our shares in the ship, he said, with a payment plan that pays out the remainder over the next 10 years. That still leaves a pretty fair balance in the operating account. The payment plan has a sliding structure, so if things get a little tight at some point, we're not going to sink you. And if things go really well, you can also pay us out early. So there's flexibility built in. He thought he was being kind, that by making things formal, it would hurt the others less. Maybe he was right. Bobby kept glancing around the room, trying to get a sense of how they were taking it. Was Alex leaning forward on his elbows because he was feeling aggressive, or did his back just ache a little? Did Amos's affable smile mean anything? Did it ever? Would they agree to the idea? If they didn't, what happened next? The anxiety in her gut stung like a scrape. So, Holden said, that's the proposal, at least. I know we've always voted on these kinds of decisions, and if there's anything in this that anyone wants to look at, or a counterproposal that anyone wants to make. The silence rang out louder than a bell. Bobby clenched her fists and released them. Clenched and released. Maybe this whole thing had been a really bad idea from the start. Maybe she should have... Alex sighed.
Well, can't say I didn't see it coming, but I'm still a little sad now it's here.
Naomi's smile was a ghost, barely there and unmistakable. Bobby felt something like the beginning of relief loosening the knot in her stomach.
As far as putting Bobby in the captain's chair, Alex went on, that's barely going to be a change. She already bosses me around plenty. So sure, I'm good with that.
Holden tilted his head the way he did when he was surprised and a little embarrassed, and Naomi put her hand on his shoulder. The unconscious physical grammar of long, intimate years together.
You saw it coming? Holden said.
Alex shrugged.
It's not like you're all that subtle. You've been getting more and more stressed for a while now.
Have I been an asshole and just didn't know? Holden asked, making about half a joke.
We'd have told you, Amos said. But there's this thing for the last couple years, I guess, where you kept looking like you had an itch you didn't want anybody seeing you scratch.
This has been a long damn tour, Alex said. If I'd re-upped for another 20 back in the day, I'd be out again by now.
Except your Navy didn't last that long, Amos said.
I'm just saying a good run's a good run. I love you, too, and I'm going to miss the hell out of you. But if it's time for something new, then it is.
Naomi's smile grew less ambiguous. Holden rocked back a few centimeters on the bench. In her imagination, Bobby's best scenarios had involved weeping and hugs. The worst, anger and recriminations. This felt like relief, only slightly colored by sorrow. It felt right. She cleared her throat.
When we get back to Medina, I'm looking to put out a call for some new hands. So, no rush, but I'm going to need to know if I'm filling more than two couches.
Alex chuckled.
Not mine. The one thing I think my life experience has been unambiguous about is whether I'm good outside a pilot station. I'm here as long as you'll have me.
Bobby relaxed another notch.
Good.
She shifted toward Amos. He shrugged.
All my stuff's here.
All right. Clarissa?
Claire was looking down, her face empty and paler than usual. She put her hands on the table, palms down, like she was pressing it back into place, like there was something that could be put back. Her smile was forced, but she nodded. She would stay.
Well, Holden said, all right then, I guess that's it, unless someone else says something they wanted to bring up.
Kind of a hard act to follow, Naomi said.
Well, yes, Holden said, but I mean, how about this, Alex said, standing up. I'm going back to my cabin and getting the scotch I've been saving for a special occasion. Let's all have a toast to Holden and the Gata. Best damn command staff a ship could hope for.
Holden's expression shifted, and his eyes took on a shine of tears, but he was grinning.
I won't say no, he said, then stood.
Alex went in for the hug, and then Naomi put her long arms around them both. Bobby looked over at Amos and pointed a thumb at the knot of three. Is this a thing we should do?
Amos rose and trundled over to them, and Bobby followed. For a long time, the crew of the Rocinante stood locked together in a long, last embrace. After a few seconds, Bobby even felt Clarissa against her side, pressing in as soft and fleeting as a moth. Officially, nothing changed after that. The long float before the deceleration burn toward the gate and Medina Station beyond it went the way they'd planned it. Houston, in his cell, was sullen and uncomfortable, but secured. Their duties and schedules, habits and customs, all had the same shape. The only thing that had altered at all was what they meant. This had become their last run together. Bobby felt like something in her body had shifted. James Holden had been a strange person from the start. Before she'd ever known him, he'd been the man who'd slandered Mars, then the one who saved it. To judge from what the greater chunk of humanity thought of him, he was an opportunistic narcissist, or a hero of free speech, a tool of the OPA, or the UN, or a loose cannon answerable to no one. She'd seen him that way, too, more than she'd known when she took her place in the Rocinante. Since then, day by day, sometimes even hour by hour, the man and his reputation had peeled away from each other. Captain James Holden of the Rocinante was a name to conjure with. The Holden she knew was a guy who drank too much coffee, got enthusiastic about weird things, and always seemed quietly worried that he would compromise his own idiosyncratic and unpredictable morality. The two versions of him were related the way a body and its shadow were. Connected, yes, each inextricably related to the other, yes, but not the same thing. And now he was moving on, and Naomi with him. Losing her was a strange thought, too, but different. Naomi had fought against being a persona in the greater world, always letting her lover take the stage so that she wouldn't have to. When she stepped away, it wouldn't change the story that other people told about the Rosinante the same way, but Bobby was going to feel her loss more. As much as Holden was the public face of the ship, Naomi was the person Bobby had come to trust in their practical day-to-day lives. Whatever Naomi said was true. And if that wasn't strictly accurate, it was close enough that Bobby and the others relied on it with confidence. When they were gone, nothing would be the same. Bobby felt the sorrow in that, but to her surprise, the joy, too. She found herself going through her rounds, moving through the ship to check everything that had already been checked, marking anything that looked off, a gas pressure level that was dropping a fraction too quickly, a doorway that showed wear, a power link that was past its replacement date. And the ship itself had changed, too. It was hers now. When she put her palm on the bulkhead and felt the thrum of the recyclers, it was her ship. When she woke, strapped into her crash couch, even the darkness felt different. She'd been a Marine. She would always be a Marine, even after that role didn't fit her anymore. Becoming the captain of the Rosinante felt right for her in a way she hadn't expected. The prospect of taking the captain's chair had the same sense of threat and anticipation that pulling on her power armor had back in the day. It was as if her old suit had changed with time, changed as much as she had, and become a ship. A worn one, yes, out of date, but dangerous. Scarred, but solid. Not just a metaphor of who Bobby was, but also who she wanted to become. She believed the others, Alex, Amos, Clarissa, were as comfortable with the shift as they claimed. And before, she'd have left it at that. Before it was her ship. Now that she was going to be captain, it was her job to check. Amos was in the machine shop, as he usually was, paging through feeds on the strategies for keeping an old gunship like theirs flying and safe. A stubble of white along the back of his skull caught the light where he hadn't shaved it in a couple of days. They were on the float, conserving reaction mass, but he was braced against the deck like he was anticipating a sudden change. Maybe he was, even if only out of habit. His thick, scarred hands tapped at the monitor, moving from subject to subject in the feed's tree. Lace plating, structural repair, overgrowth in microflora-based air recyclers, auto-adapting power grids. All the thousand improvements that study of the alien technologies had spun off. He understood them all. It was easy to forget sometimes the depth of focus and intelligence behind Amos's cheerful violence. "Hey, big man," Bobby said, pulling herself to a stop with one of the handholds. "Hey, Captain Babs," he said. "How's it going?" He looked over at her. "Well, I'm a little nervous about the plating we put down by the drive at that depot back on Stoddard. A lot of folks are seeing flaking with that batch under radiation bombardment. Figure when we hit Medina, I should hop outside and take a peek. Hate to have that turn into baklava on us when we were counting on it." "That would suck," Bobby agreed. "Lace plating's great when it's great," Amos said, turning back to his screen. "How's the rest of it?" Bobby asked. Amos shrugged, flicked through the feed.
Is what it is, I figure.
The silence settled between them. Bobby scratched her neck, the soft sound of nails against skin louder than anything else in the room. She didn't know how to ask if he was going to be okay with Holden and Naomi leaving him behind.
Are you going to be okay with Holden and Naomi leaving?
Yep, Amos said.
Why? You worried about it?
A little, Bobby said, surprised to discover that it was true.
I mean, I know you saw it coming before Holden did. I think all of us did. But you've shipped with them for a lot of years.
Yeah, but my favorite thing about Holden was knowing he'd take a bullet for any one of the crew.
Pretty sure you actually have taken a few for us, so that ain't changing, Amos said, then paused for a moment.
You might should check in with Peaches, though.
You think?
Yep, Amos said.
And that was that. Bobby pulled herself back out. Clarissa was in the medical bay, strapped into one of the auto docks. Tubes ran from gently purring machinery into the port on the woman's side, blood flowing out of the thin body and then being pumped back in. Her skin was the color of a wax candle and stretched tight against her cheekbones. She still smiled and raised a hand in greeting when Bobby floated in. As a technician, Clarissa Mao had always been one of the best Bobby had worked with. She had the sense that the thin woman's drive came out of a kind of anger and desperation, working to keep some greater darkness at bay. It was an impulse Bobby understood.
"Rough patch?" Bobby asked, nodding toward the blood-filled tubes.
"Not a great one," Clarissa said. "I'll be back on my feet tomorrow, though. Promise."
"No rush," Bobby said. "We're doing fine."
"I know, it's just..." Bobby cracked her knuckles. The auto dock chimed to itself and took another long draw of Clarissa's blood.
"You wanted something?" she said, looking into Bobby's eyes.
"It's okay, you can say it."
"I'm not your captain yet," Bobby said, "but I'm going to be."
It was the first time she'd said the words out loud. They felt good enough that she said them again.
"I'm going to be. And that's going to put me in a position where I'm responsible for you. For your well-being."
She hadn't thought about her team in years. Her old team. Hillman. Gorob. Travis. Saeed. Her last command before this. For a moment, they were in the room, invisible and voiceless, but as present as Clarissa. Bobby swallowed and bit back a smile. This was it. This was what she'd been trying to find her way back to all these years. This was why it mattered that she do it right this time.
"And if I'm responsible for your well-being," she said, "we need to talk."
"All right.
This thing with your old implants, that's going to get worse instead of better," Bobby said.
"I know," Clarissa said. "I'd take my implants out if it wouldn't kill me faster." She smiled, inviting Bobby to smile with her, making the truth into something like a joke.
"When we get to Medina, I'm going to hire on fresh crew," Bobby said. "Not co-owners in the ship the way we are, just paid hands. Part of that is Holden and Naomi leaving."
"But you can also hire someone for my place," Clarissa said. Tears welled up, sheeting across her eyes as she nodded. The auto dock chimed again, pushing her purified blood back down into her.
"If you want to stay on Medina, you can," Bobby said. "If you want to stay with the ship, you're welcome here."
On the float, Clarissa's tears didn't fall. The surface tension held them to her until she shook her head, and then they'd form a dozen scattered balls of saline that in time would get sucked into the recycler, and leave the air smelling a little more of sorrow and the sea.
I... Clarissa began, then shook her head and shrugged helplessly. I thought I'd be the first one to leave.
She sobbed once, and Bobby pushed over to her, took her hand. Clarissa's fingers were thin, but her grip was stronger than Bobby expected. They stayed there together until Clarissa's breath grew less ragged. Clarissa brought her other hand over and rested it on Bobby's arm. There was some color in her cheeks again, but Bobby didn't know if it was the flush of emotion or the medical systems doing their job. Maybe both.
I understand, Bobby said. It's hard losing someone.
Yeah, Clarissa said, and I don't know. Something about it seems less dignified when it's Holden. You know what I mean? Of all the people to get choked up over.
No, Bobby said. You don't need to make light of it.
Clarissa opened her mouth, closed it again, nodded.
I'll miss him is all.
I know.
I will too.
And look, if you don't want to talk about it now, I can just check your file for your medical plan and end-of-life choices. Whatever you and Holden worked out, I'm going to honor it.
Clarissa's pale, thin brows knotted.
Holden? I didn't work out anything with Holden.
Bobby felt a little tug of surprise.
No?
We don't talk about things like that, Clarissa said. I talked to Amos. He knows I want to stay here. With him. If things ever get too bad, he promised he'd make it easier for me when the time comes.
Okay, Bobby said. That's good to know.
And important, she thought to herself, to fully document so that if it happens in someone else's jurisdiction, no one gets arrested for murder. How the hell could Holden not have done that?
You're sure Holden never talked about this with you?
Clarissa shook her head. The autodoc finished its run. The tubes detached from the port in Clarissa's skin and slid back into the body of the ship like overly polite snakes.
Okay, then, Bobby said. I know now. I'll make sure you're taken care of, and Amos, too.
Thank you, and I'm sorry.
About what?
I've been a little self-pitying about Naomi and Holden, Clarissa said. I didn't mean to make it anyone else's problem. I'll get back to duty.
Everyone gets to mourn how they need to, Bobby said. And then everyone needs to get their asses back to work.
Yes, sir, Clarissa said with a sharp, if ironic, salute. I'm glad we had this talk.
I am too, Bobby said as she pulled herself to the door. And I'm amazed that Holden never did.
For the first time, Bobby had the sense that there were some ways, not all, but some, in which she was going to be a much better captain than he'd been.
Chapter 10. Drummer.
Okay, Drummer said. It felt like for the thousandth time. But are these things naturally occurring or not? Cameron Tour, the union science advisor, was an impressively tall, gangly man with an Adam's apple the size of a thumb and faded tattoos on each of his knuckles. He'd come into the service when Tion was president of the union and kept the job through Walker and Sandrani. As old as he was, and as much as he'd seen, she had expected him to have an air of condescension, but he'd only ever come across as a little ill at ease. His chuckle now was apologetic.
That's a good question, semantically speaking, he said. The difference between something made by nature and something made by beings that evolved up within nature, Sasa?
Difficult, Emily Santos Baca agreed. She was the representative of the Policy Council for the Union's board.
Officially, she didn't have a higher rank than any of the other counselors. But she got along with Drummer better than any of the others. It made her a sort of first among equals. She was younger than Drummer by exactly 2 years. They even had the same birthday. It made Drummer like the woman just a little bit, even when she was being a pain in the ass. Drummer looked at the images again. The whatever it was little longer than 2 hand-widths together, curved like a claw or a seed pod, and shining green and gray in the sunlight outside Galish Complex on Fusang. She started the image playback, and the young man sprang into life, slotting one claw, pod, whatever the hell it was, into another with an audible click to create an empty space roughly the shape of an almond. Light flickered into the space, shifting shapes that danced on the edge of meaning. The young man grinned into the camera and said the same things he had every time she'd watched him. Watching the light is associated with feelings of great peace and connection with all forms of life in the galaxy, and appears to stimulate blah, blah, fucking blah. She stopped it again. "Millions of them?" she asked. "So far," Tour agreed. "Once the mine goes deeper, they may find more." Fuck. The colony worlds had begun, simply enough. A few households, a few townships, a desperate scrabble against the local biosphere to make clean water and edible food. Sometimes colonies would falter and die before help could arrive. Sometimes they'd give up and evacuate. But more than a few took root on the rocks and unfamiliar soil of the distant planets, and as they found their niches, as they became stable, the first wave of deep exploration had begun. The massive underwater transport arches on Corazon Sagrado, the light-bending moths on Persephone, the programmable antibiotics from Illus. Evolution alone had created all the wonders and complexities of Earth. That same thing 1,300 times over would have been challenge enough. But added to that were the artifacts of the dead species of whatever the hell they'd been that had designed the protomolecule gates, the slow zone, the massive and eternal cities that seemed to exist somewhere on every world they'd discovered. Artifacts of alien toolmakers that had been able and willing to hijack all life on Earth just to make one more road between the stars. Any of it could be the key to unimagined miracles. Or catastrophe. Or placebo-euphoric snake-oil light show bullshit. The images from the seed pods could be the encrypted records of the fallen civilization that had built miracles they were still only beginning to understand. Or they could be the spores of whatever had killed them. Or they could be lava lamps. Who fucking knew? The science stations on Kinley are very anxious to get a shipment for study, Santos Baca said. But without knowing whether these are technological artifacts or natural resources, which, Tour apologized, is difficult to determine with only the resources on Fusang. I get it, Drummer said, and shifted to look at Santos Baca. Isn't this kind of decision pretty much within your wheelhouse? I have the votes to allow the contract, Santos Baca said, but I don't have enough to override a veto. Drummer nodded. The question wasn't whether moving psychoactive alien seed pods between worlds was a good idea, so much as whether someone was going to lose face in front of a committee. Thus were the great decisions of history made. If we don't think they pose an immediate danger, ship them as alien artifacts with a third-level isolation protocol, and I'll let it pass. Thank you, Santos Baca said, rising from her seat. A moment later, Tour did the same. Stay with me for a minute, Emily, Drummer said, shutting down the demonstration video from Fusang. There's something else I wanted to talk to you about. Tuor left, closing the door behind him, and Santos Baca sank back into her